loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, sitting in for co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, we'll discuss the biggest news so far this week, including the government shutdown, confirmation hearings for Trump's attorney general, the killing of U.S. soldiers in Syria, and more. And then we continue our regular segment called Beyond Nuclear, where we take a look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States with Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, several U.S. troops have reportedly been killed in northern Syria in a bomb blast claimed by ISIS. Opponents of a U.S. withdrawal from the country, something long demanded by Syria's sovereign government, seized on this development to try to derail the pullout. Next, Marzia Hashemi, an American journalist, was arrested on Sunday and is still being held without charge by the FBI. Hashemi works for the Iranian outlet Press TV, and many are speculating that her detention is yet another move in the Trump administration's effort to ramp up pressure on Iran and alternative journalists. Then, mainstream media outlets across the country are in a frenzy over Donald Trump's decision to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin without keeping official records. We'll put this issue into context. Meanwhile, new developments in the ongoing struggle between the FBI and the White House have emerged, involving former FBI General Counsel James Baker. And then, Purdue Pharmaceutical Corporation plays a major role fueling the opioid crisis, an epidemic that has made the Sackler family, who owns the company, fabulously wealthy. Now, new internal documents reveal the direct involvement of the Sacklers in an ad campaign seeking to shift the blame for the crisis. And finally, a top aide to imprisoned drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman testified in court today that El Chapo paid a $100 million bribe to former Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto. While this is yet to be verified, the claim highlights the endemic corruption among the country's political elites and newly elected progressive President Obrador's efforts to end it. And in other headlines, UK Prime Minister Theresa May survived a no-confidence vote today called by the opposition Labour Party. The vote was 325-306. The no-confidence vote comes after May suffered a serious defeat yesterday when Parliament overwhelmingly voted down the deal she negotiated on the terms of Britain's exit from the European Union. As the partial government shutdown enters its 26th day, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has asked President Trump to delay his annual State of the Union address, which was scheduled for January 29th. Trump is expected to use the speech as an opportunity to shift blame for the shutdown to Democrats. Karen Pence, wife of Vice President Mike Pence, is being criticized for taking a part-time job teaching art at Emmanuel Christian School in Northern Virginia. The school has a policy banning gay students, employees, and parents. Mike Pence has long been associated with the most hardline anti-LGBTQ elements of U.S. politics. EPA Acting Administrator Andrew Wheeler is undergoing nomination hearings where he's touted his support for deregulation. He was a top aide to Republican Senator Jim Inhofe, who is a climate change denier. Those are today's headlines. You are listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the biggest stories of the week so far. It's Wednesday. That means it's time for our weekly segment called In the News, where we look at the most important ongoing developments of the week so far and put them into perspective. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Jackie Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's start with the government shutdown. We're in Washington, D.C. Maybe not all parts of the country are affected. Certainly, it's uneven, but people in the Washington, D.C. area are affected. Let's talk about that, Jackie.
If you walk around the National Mall, there's a little less trash because of overspilling the garbage cans, but it's still a pretty disgusting sight because there are no federal employees to do the cleanup. A lot of businesses, a lot of eateries that rely on those federal employees for their business during the week, they're suffering because people aren't buying lunch. And people are still having to pay their bills. A lot of federal employees in this area still have to pay their bills. They miss their first paycheck. Their mortgages are due. Their rents are due. They still have to buy groceries for their families. And there is no end in sight to this. And the advice from the administration and different agencies to, you know, for people to talk to their creditors and realtors, and the creditors don't care. They don't care. Some will be understanding, but most just want their money. So people are hurting. And all of this is because of a foolish campaign promise that was made by Trump to build a wall that is not needed and isn't going to work to address any of the issues that he claims are problems.
Walter, not only are more workers feeling the pinch because they're going without pay, of course, the federal government has only been partially shut down. Many workers have been still working, but working without pay, especially those workers that are deemed to be essential employees. There's new news. The Trump administration has ordered now thousands of furloughed federal employees back to work without pay to inspect planes, issue tax refunds, monitor food safety, and facilitate the sale of offshore oil drilling rights. Of course, that's an essential service because we have to get more oil wells in the middle of, say, the Gulf of Mexico. That always works out well. Anyway, here's tens of thousands of workers. There's a federal lawsuit, or let me put it a different way, a lawsuit from federal workers in the federal court saying that being compelled to work without pay is a violation of the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery in the United States. Again, this is not a small number of people who are being compelled to work without pay and who, in fact, have no relief from the government when they have to pay their bills. Last week, the Coast Guard, as we talked about, sent out this guidance encouraging unpaid federal workers to, one, hold garage sales, and two, start babysitting. Anyway, go ahead, Walter.
Yeah, I mean, it shows, and it's further evidence, as if we needed further evidence, that the Trump administration doesn't care one bit about workers. I mean, these obviously affects, you know, a particular a subset of the working class of people who are employed by the federal government. But I think it's indicative of a broader disregard for the interests of ordinary working people. I mean, Donald Trump is a real estate billionaire, maybe. I mean, he's an unbelievably rich person. He lives completely removed from anybody who has to, you know, live paycheck to paycheck or has to worry about bills. I mean, Donald Trump's never worried about that in his life. And you know what? Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer probably haven't either. And I think they're perfectly content. I mean, they feel like they're winning, right? So, you know, why make any sort of maneuver? Why amp up the pressure even on Donald Trump to end the shutdown when the shutdown is actually kind of working in their favor in terms of the optics, the public relations? But yeah, I think it's just completely ridiculous that I mean, thousands and thousands of people are being ordered to work and then just not paid for their labor.
Congress is getting paid. Donald Trump doesn't need to get paid, apparently, because he's already a billionaire. Again, why should Congress be paid when Congress, which controls the purse strings, which is responsible for the release of a budget for the authorization and appropriation of funds, why should they be work? Why should they be paid?
They shouldn't be paid. They should absolutely not be paid. I agree with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez when she said last week that when the government shuts down and federal workers are not paid and contractors are not paid, then Congress shouldn't be paid either. Although that's something that Congress is going to have to pass a bill to do, which we know they're not going to. So how do we even broach that type of how do we do that? How do we do that when the people who are happy allowing this to happen, we know would never vote on such a measure to punish themselves for letting it happen.
Indeed. And they have great health care. They have Cadillac health care plans. I mean, why not have a law that says that no elected official that's representing we the people should have benefits paid for by we the people, including health care and their salary, while at the same time, the rest of the population, it's not only denied these benefits, this guarantee, it's not even discussed as if it would be in the course of a real political discourse that people should have these things that Congress has as a right.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, the Congress is completely unrepresentative of the people of the United States. I mean, there are more millionaires in. I mean, millionaires are the best represented group in Congress. You know, and there are people who there's not a single worker in Congress. There's not a single immigrant in Congress because you wouldn't be allowed to run for office. There's not a single union leader elected to Congress. There's not a single social movement leader elected to Congress. You know, it's a leadership of the country, but it's a leadership drawn from a very particular subset of the population, which is wealthy people and professionals.
Let's go on to the next subject. Another big story. William Barr, Donald Trump's nominee to replace Jeff Sessions as Attorney General. Just when you think it couldn't get worse, Jackie, that Jeff Sessions would be the worst attorney general ever, this is like the return of Bill Barr, the architect of mass incarceration.
Yeah, the return of the return of Bill Barr. Bill Barr strikes back again. That's what, I mean, he was attorney general for a short period of time before, I think it was under Bush. And this was in 92, I think it was, when these writings surfaced about his love of mass incarceration. And he basically said, we're not incarcerating too many people. We're not incarcerating. The problem is we're not incarcerating enough people. The problem is that we're not incarcerating. Well, we're not spending enough money on building more prisons because we need to incarcerate more people. And of course, he uses the backward logic of the people who would see the most benefit from more incarceration are those poor black people in those crime-ridden neighborhoods, because that's where we would incarcerate most of those people from. But as is usual with this kind of bizarre conservative backward logic, they don't talk about providing more jobs. They don't talk about providing quality education, access to quality health care, quality housing. They want to lock people up. And true to form, for the Democrats, during the confirmation hearing, I don't think any of them brought any of this up. The focus was all on how he would respond to the Mueller investigation. And it's just maddening. It's maddening.
Yeah. One of the things that William Barr said yesterday was that he would be okay with arresting journalists. I want to read to you a little bit from the testimony. Here's an AOL story. During his confirmation hearing on Tuesday, Attorney General nominee William Barr was asked by Senator Amy Klobuchar, a Democrat of Minnesota, whether his Justice Department would, quote, jail journalists for doing their jobs, close quote. That's her question. Barr, President Trump's pick for the nation's top law enforcement officer, said he could envision a situation where a news organization or individual journalists could be held in contempt of court. Here's what he said. I think that, you know, I know there are guidelines in place, and I can conceive of situations where, you know, as a last resort, and where a news organization has run through a red flag or something like that, knows that they're putting out stuff that will hurt the country. There could be a situation where somebody could be held in contempt. Wow. I mean, why aren't the journalists up in arms about this? Here we have Julian Assange, an editor of a publication, WikiLeaks, that the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post, they all use WikiLeaks stuff. None of it has proved to be untrue. The U.S. government is getting ready to jail Assange. And here you have the incoming attorney general say, yeah, if you cross a red flag. Well, who sets up these red flags? I mean, what is the First Amendment? I mean, isn't that a protection against the government setting up red flags?
Right. And there are so many different scenarios where something like that can be used and abused by people in power, by whatever administration is in office, if this precedent is set. And I mean, it's not like it hasn't been set before. Of course, there's the case of Julian Assange and others. I mean, you know, let's say it's the run up to a war, right? And, you know, the government doesn't like the particular editorial line of a publication, and then they try to compel a journalist to give up their source to try to undercut their reporting on that war. Or, you know, say there's an economic crisis and, you know, they want to protect their buddies. And well, I mean, there's just so many scenarios where the prosecution of journalists can be used to have a chilling effect on people's right to express, well, free speech, First Amendment rights, the right to a free press, to freedom of speech. And yeah, it's an extremely dangerous thing, along with, of course, the love of incarceration generally, you know, as a form of social control to keep, you know, oppressed communities, you know, pacified or under control. There's also sort of more targeted repressive measures that can be used for political reasons.
Well, talking about the arrest of journalists, another story, and we're going to cover this later in the show, Jackie, is that an American journalist working for Iran's English language press TV in Tehran, her name is Marzeh Hashemi. She was originally named Melanie Franklin. She's an American, African-American woman living in St. Louis, has children, has a family there. She got off the plane on Sunday from St. Louis, and she's arrested by the FBI. As we speak right now, this woman is still in jail on unspecified charges. She's a journalist. She's a presenter, an anchor on the show The Debate, hosted by Press TV. Again, just think if Russia did this. Think if North Korea did this. A journalist gets off the plane and she's working, say, for an American media outlet. She gets off the plane in Beijing or Moscow and she's immediately arrested with unspecified charges. That would be a big deal. I don't see much of this. I'm reading about it in Al Jazeera.
Yeah.
I'm reading about it on RT, on Sputnik. There was one story in Reuters. American mainstream media right now is not covering the arrest of this African-American woman, mother. She got off a plane, unspecified charges. That's the FBI.
Yeah. I mean, and especially for the Black community in the United States, we're, you know, those of us who know about this story are like, well, yeah, that is the FBI. This is exactly what they do. And it's not a surprise to us. But it shouldn't be a surprise, I don't think, that mainstream media, that corporate-owned media is not covering this story because they're controlled by the same people who control our Congress. So, of course, they're not going to highlight this story of an American citizen being detained under no charges. We don't know why she was detained other than she works for Iranian television. And so the assumption obviously is by her detainment that she is a quote unquote, I'm doing air quotes now, agent of our sworn enemy, Iran.
Yeah, she's an American working for an Iranian media outlet. I mean, all kinds of people of different nationalities work for different media outlets, Walter. Coming right after William Barr's testimony where he says, well, if you cross a red line, maybe working for an English language Iranian media outlet is crossing somebody's red line in the FBI. And again, it has to be seen in the context of U.S. foreign policy because we have Trump and Pompeo in particular, but John Bolton too, you know, itching for a confrontation with Iran. Maybe she's just sort of a human casualties, sort of collateral damage in this escalating confrontation, again, because Trump and the Trump administration want a confrontation of some type with the Iranian government.
Yeah, the escalation in the U.S. regime change push, and I think that's what it is. I mean, the U.S. wants to install a pliant regime in Iran. That's been their goal since the 1979 revolution. You know, I think that this can be seen correctly as one more step in that escalation. I mean, there's going to be a conference in Poland next month, too, where, you know, people will talk about delegations from different countries. We'll talk about the supposed Iranian threat. In May, the sanctions waivers that many countries have that allows them to continue or allowed them for 6 additional months to buy Iranian oil, those will expire, so the economic strangulation on the country will be deepened. And yeah, and we have now this journalist who works for an Iranian media outlet being arrested for no reason.
Well, we don't know the reason. It's unspecified charges.
Yeah, right. And, you know, according to some reports, she's being really, really badly abused in custody. I mean, she's a Muslim. And so, you know, of course, you don't need pork, but she's exclusively being, according to these reports, you know, offered pork for food. And so, you know, the only thing she's been able to eat for like a couple of days is crackers, apparently. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just terrible. And then there's also the angle of the attack on alternative media. I mean, I think if most Americans watch Press TV, and I watch it from time to time and read their articles, they'd be much better informed about the world. I mean, Press TV covers things that just are completely blacked out of the U.S. media, like the war in Yemen.
Well, that's the thing. You know, the U.S. government sets up blockades and sanctions and embargoes against targeted countries. It's mainly designed to deny the people who live in those countries the essentials for life, like food or medicine, or to be able to have decent jobs, or to have currency that isn't completely devalued. But there's another part of the blockades. There's another part, which is to deny the American people information, which can only be understood or appreciated if you get it from something other than a corporate-owned media, which is also part of the targeting effort. So would Americans benefit from reading, say, Iranian media? Yes. What about Russian media? What about Chinese media? What about North Korean media? What about Venezuelan media? Would we, I mean, the assumption here is that if Americans read these media outlets, that somehow their minds will be automatically poisoned. But that's absolutely the definition of a police state imposing a tyranny, a thought police, a tyranny on people. The blockade goes both ways.
Yeah, and really, for those of us who do read alternative media and read media outlets from different countries, we realize that the truth of the matter is, if we access news from these other outlets, our minds aren't poisoned. Our minds are actually opened up not to nefarious and shady things, but our minds are opened up to the lies that our own government tells us through our media. So our access, the access to alternative media and foreign media for the American people, is a threat to the power that the government and the corporate-owned media has on information and basically the propagandizing of the American population in regard to foreign affairs.
Walter, another story that is kind of big news so far this week was the New York Times and other media reports that Donald Trump met with Vladimir Putin, and he met without note takers, or he took the notes away in one case, or he met without a translator, or things like this, as if this, and this is, they say it almost explicitly, which puts the cloud over Donald Trump in an even bigger way, because does it signify that Trump might have been saying things to Putin in private that indicate that Putin has something on Donald Trump? Like, that's the message. Now, this information about how Putin and Trump met obviously was based on a leak, and a leak came from the intelligence agencies to the media. We're going to talk more about this in depth in another segment here on Loud and Clear today. But one thing that is very interesting is that this would not be unprecedented. Richard Nixon, for instance, met with Brezhnev and with Mao Zedong without anybody else in the room, in terms of having official, say, State Department stenographers, note takers, or aides, because he didn't want to have them in the room because he was also worried about leaks. Again, not unprecedented.
Yeah, I mean, there's a deep conflict that's going on at the very summits of the political establishment in the United States, and you don't have to, you know, swear loyalty or affix yourself to one side or the other to just understand what's going on. You know, there are people who think that, you know, Donald Trump is completely unfit to be the president, not for the reason that, you know, we think he's unfit to be the president, because he's a, you know, just monstrous enemy of poor and working class and immigrants and black people and, you know, I mean, just everybody. That's not why there's a big section of the elite that rejects Donald Trump. It's because he's a poor manager. He's an incompetent manager of this empire. And, you know, he is willing to make decisions that they think are completely contrary to the interests of that empire. So, for instance, the withdrawal of troops from Syria, some sort of reduction in tensions with Russia, you know, this huge nuclear armed superpower, maybe not a bad idea. You know, talking to North Korea is another instance of this. And so I think Donald Trump is obviously aware of that. He's aware that there's, you know, enemies of his administration that are actually inside of his administration, right? I mean, there's, you know, a state that exists. You don't have to call it the deep state. There's a state that sort of exists regardless of what administration happens to be in office. And so, you know, he's taking measures to sort of protect the integrity of his own diplomatic efforts, some of which are terrible, some of which are good. I mean, I happen to think that, you know, a reduction of tensions with Russia is like a positive thing for us here in the United States and for the world generally. And so, yeah, I mean, that's the reason, I think, why, you know, those decisions were made to have, you know, no official transcripts or whatever, because I think rightly, he assumed that it would just be leaked to the media and used to make his administration look bad.
Jackie, I want to go to Syria, too, and we only have a limited amount of time. But remember when President Obama was caught on mic, he was talking to then-Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, and he was talking about the possibility of a new nuclear arms deal with Russia, but he couldn't do it right now, he said. He didn't know he was on camera because an election was coming up. So the mic caught him saying this: "This is my last election. After my election, I have more flexibility." And then Medvedev says, "I will transmit this information to Vladimir," meaning Putin. And of course, Medvedev was Putin's protege and longtime considered number two in the Moscow political structure. Can you imagine if Donald Trump was caught on mic saying to Putin, just wait till after the 2020 election, then we'll work this out. I need more flexibility. Can you imagine what the reaction would be?
I actually imagine that's almost precisely what he said, which is why, you know, the Obama hot mic gaffe is exactly why he didn't want any type of recording device, because he didn't want people, just like you said, he didn't want people to hear the deal that he's making with, you know, his supposed sworn enemy, Putin, who's not, he's not supposed to be a puppet of. So, you know, he doesn't want people to say, no, he really is a puppet of Putin, because he doesn't want to appear weak and compliant with, you know, America's sworn enemy. But that's exactly what I imagined he said.
Yeah. Again, if Trump had said that and it was caught on mic right now, it would be like case closed, mm-hmm. about the fact that he's a puppet.
Yeah.
But that was President Obama, everybody. Mm-hmm. He said it on a mic that he thought was closed. He leaned over. He talks to the Russian president, says, you know, basically pass the message to Vladimir. Just wait till after the election. Then we'll make a deal. Anyway, 90 seconds left, Walter. American soldiers killed by a terrorist suicide attack in Manbij. That's northern Syria. Some of the media reports saying it'll be all the worse now because Donald Trump is taking American troops out of Syria. We're going to talk about this in another segment in depth. But it would seem to me that it can't get worse for American troops if they come home, but because that means they won't be killed in terrorist suicide bomb attacks.
Yeah, that's right. And it's also based on a complete fantasy about where ISIS comes from. It's just like, you know, if the United States withdraws from the Middle East, then ISIS will flourish. Well, it's the U.S. presence in the Middle East that created ISIS in the first place, because, you know, when the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003, led to the death of over a million people, it imposed an explicitly sectarian political system on Iraq. In the chaos of that civil war, you know, Al-Qaeda arose. Al-Qaeda move in Iraq moved over to Syria, and that's where you get ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. And the idea that the United States withdrawing from this, you know, 16-year-long military conflict in the region would make it worse, it totally defies logic.
Yeah. Before the U.S. invaded Iraq, there was no ISIS in Iraq. Before the U.S. bombed Libya, there was no ISIS in Libya. Before the U.S. intervened along with its proxies in Syria, there was no ISIS in Syria. So it's not going to get worse by the U.S. leaving. It's going to get a whole lot better. Anyway, that's all the time we have. We're going to talk about some of these other stories, the ones we touched on in depth in our second hour. So stay with us. We're joined from Washington by Jackie Lookman. Jackie is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. It's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment called Beyond Nuclear, where we take a look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. We're joined in studio by Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. He joins us every Wednesday for this segment. You can check out his work and the work of their organization at beyondnuclear.org. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Kevin, Nicole, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
Good to be here.
Kevin, have you gone to the movies?
Yes, I saw Vice recently.
And?
Well, you know, it was a minor part of the movie, but the Energy Policy Act of 2005, which Cheney essentially wrote at the behest of energy lobbyists, was a traumatic part of the film for me to live through again.
So Vice is about the reign of Dick Cheney. The movie leaves the impression that it's Dick Cheney's government, not George W. Bush. It was the vice president's government, not the president's government. Walk through some other historically important and maybe forgotten points having to do with energy, and I think it's important. Jimmy Carter, when he assumed office in January 1977, post-Watergate, post-Vietnam, people were a little bit optimistic that maybe something would change. And Carter actually did some things in terms of energy, in terms of solar energy, that were quite important. The movie covers it, and then it covers what happens next when Ronald Reagan takes the place of Jimmy Carter.
Well, Carter put solar panels on the White House, and they played a documentary clip in the film. Even though it's a drama, they played Carter giving a speech that was very cutting edge about the promise of solar power technology. Again, this was, you know, the mid-70s, right? So the next scene when Reagan comes to power is one of his first acts is to tear those panels off, you know, tear down this wall, tear those panels off the White House. And an advisor to Beyond Nuclear, Steve Strong of Solar Design Associates in Massachusetts, under George W. Bush, under Cheney, got a contract to put solar panels on the pool area of the White House. And his joke is he put them on very well. They're going to be very hard to take off if they ever try to.
But it says a lot, too, about how this tug of war over what should be, you know, understandably basic, like why not use renewable energy sources? You had Jimmy Carter sort of ahead of the game a little bit for a president of the United States. And usually I say ahead of the game, not because it was impossible to think about solar energy back then, but because of the inordinate influence of the oil industry and the gas industry and the nuclear industry on all presidents, on all parts of the U.S. government. He was thinking ahead. And then you had Ronald Reagan ripping solar panels off as one of his first acts off of the White House. In other words, it comes back. It circles around. We have Donald Trump coming in and immediately undoing the Paris Climate Treaty agreements that the Obama administration signed, immediately undoing auto emission standards. It's the kind of fickleness of the U.S. government where, based on political partisanship, whatever happens that could or even marginally good can be ripped away willy-nilly by the next person coming into office.
Well, it's touched on real briefly in the film, but the Energy Policy Act of 2005 that Bush and Cheney put into law has had huge repercussions. So for one thing, fracking came out of it. That's kind of a big deal. And another thing was on the nuclear power side, $13 billion in subsidies to begin with. And actually, the subsidies were unlimited because the nuclear loan guarantees were unlimited. And not long after the passage of the bill, it was August 8th of 2005, and they signed the bill. It was Bush out in New Mexico at Sandia National Labs with Domenici and Bingaman to either side of him, which was unprecedented, I think, in Senate history for two senators from the same state to be the chairman and the ranking member of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee or any other committee. And New Mexico, being in the talons of the nuclear industry, power and weapons, they sign this new law that's not just nuclear, it's all energy, surrounded at Sandia by the greatest concentration of nuclear warheads on planet Earth, which are stored in the mountains at Sandia National Lab. And it was all very symbolic and very enigmatic. And we're going to be talking more about New Mexico later in the show today. It's set the stage for what we still face to this day, you know, two reactors being built in Georgia that will probably go belly up, and that $12 billion in nuclear loan guarantees will vanish into the atmosphere. It will vaporize, lost to the U.S. Treasury. That moment, August 8th, 2005, set the stage for all this.
Yeah. So finally, before we go on to our other topics, should people watch that movie?
Sure. Yeah. And remember that there was an anti-war movement that's not shown in the movie.
That was the infuriating part of the movie for me, because we talk about in the movie Dick Cheney's role, his macabre and Machiavellian role in terms of dragging the country to a war based on lies, the idea that Iraq was a great threat, that it had weapons of mass destruction. Iraq did not. The U.S. government knew it did not. There had been 13,000 weapons inspections all over that small country over many, many years. Even the weapons inspectors knew that there weren't weapons of mass destruction. It was conjured up. But the thing that's missing in the movie, Vice, is there's no mention of the fact that the American people, in large measure, were in majority sentiment until the very last days before the war, not only opposed to the war, but coming out against the war in record numbers. We were organizing demonstrations month after month after month, starting in October 2002, where literally hundreds of thousands and then millions of people were demonstrating on the same day, month after month after month. And again, that's the problem with the movie. And it's a problem with politics that are simply the politics of critique, or the problems of observation, or there's kind of a dilettantism to that, where the anti-war sentiment of the American people is dismissed, not part of the movie, not even one reference. And again, if we think about the nuclear industry, it's, yes, we can talk about how bad it is, how corrupt it is, how it's sort of the negation of democracy because it has such a stranglehold over the government. But if we talk about it like that without talking about organizations like yours, Kevin, like BeyondNuclear.org and so many other people of conscience and people of knowledge, people of wisdom who are not simply being wise, not simply being knowledgeable, they're acting, they're trying to make a difference. And that's so important. And that was what was left out of the movie.
And, you know, you got me to thinking about, let's take the Manhattan Project where nuclear weapons came from. There were Manhattan Project scientists, one of whom, Rotblat, you know, bless his soul, walked off the project as soon as Nazi Germany surrendered. Because the whole bomb project was supposed to be to beat the Nazis to the bomb, which was a pretty dire prospect. But as Richard Rhodes in his book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, has documented quite well, just after D-Day, June of 44, there was an advance scout mission by the Allies deep behind enemy lines that discovered that the Nazi bomb program had been abandoned. So actually, we knew like in mid-1944 that there was not a Nazi bomb program. And they went ahead and they nuked Hiroshima and Nagasaki anyway. But, you know, the resistance you mentioned would include the atomic scientists who signed the petition that said, let's not do this. And the petition sat on Leslie Groves' desk at the Pentagon and was never delivered to Roosevelt or Truman. And two cities got nuked.
You know, when Howard Zinn wrote the book, The People's History of the United States, it was such an important contribution because the fact of the matter is we people in the United States, for the most part, don't know anything about our history. We don't know anything. We don't know about this. We don't know about the fact that there's two sides or three sides or four sides. We don't know about the fact that there's resistance and that there's organization. It's always the history of great men. I mean, it could be a few great women, but mainly great men, be they evil or wonderful. But the history is a history about them. Who was the president? Who was the CEO? Who was the movie mogul? And none of this story about how the people actually shape and change historical patterns and historical decisions. Many times the people fail, but they keep fighting, or the next generation, if it knows about what came before them, uses what came before them as sort of a building block to take next steps. That's why the history issue is so important. I wish we could devote almost like an entire show to doing like the people's history, the untold history of these kind of struggles. Anyway,
I just wanted to say something quickly before we move on. As a recent studier of history, you know, the, like you were saying, the history we learned in high school and middle school and college, if you did that, you know, it's always incomplete, right? It doesn't always include the people's history. And when it does, it's because the people's movement was so, so strong that there was no way to possibly avoid it. But, you know, when I lived through, you know, I think I was in high school during the anti-war movement against the Iraq War, and I have very strong memories of how powerful that movement was. And so, you know, I think people in my generation remember that because we were there and we saw it. But I wonder, you know, in 50 years and 100 years, will that be remembered when there's movies like Vice that completely rewrite that kind of history? When we look at, for example, even as important history to the U.S. and to the public as slavery times, right? When we look back at that, we think, well, the Civil War was fought because the North really didn't like slavery and they were, you know, they stood strong to, you know, really fight the slave economy. But we know that's not actually true, right? That there were, we only know now as I've started to restudy history and to learn more about the people's history, we know that there were a lot of people standing strong in the North, but that the Northern capitalists were fine. You know, they were totally fine with slavery and were profiting off of it. So it's just, it's really interesting to look back and to see what's included and what's not. And really, I think it's left up to us to really try to force or to try to get as strong a people's movement as possible to make sure that we are included.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And the truth is, if you go back, and we're going to leave this topic and go to nuclear issues now, but but, you know, if you look back and actually see what happened in the years leading to up to the U.S. Civil War, it wasn't the Northern aggression against slavery, but the Southern aggression against the free states. The South wanted to expand slavery in the West, and through the Dred Scott decision, make slavery's laws the laws of the North. And so it was the slaveocracy's competition with Northern capital that, you know, sort of basically forced the Northern capitalists to declare war against the South after the South had declared war on the North. In other words, that's an important part of that story. Anyway, big, big, complicated story.
Big, complicated story that was overly simplified and does not include, right, like the real narratives of what happened in the history books I read, at least in Richmond, Virginia, growing up.
And especially in Richmond.
Especially in Richmond.
But Richmond, you know, again, my favorite line, one of my favorite lines from Malcolm X when he said, the South. He said, what is the South? He said, it's not the Mason-Dixon line. It's the U.S.-Canada border.
Exactly. But let's move on to New Mexico. As you were saying, Kevin, there's a lot going on in New Mexico right now. A press release just released today from the environmental coalition that's working against some of these huge, high-level radioactive waste dumps. I'm going to read a little bit from that press release. So there's a couple of things going on next week around it. And so, again, I'm going to start reading from the press release here. The environmental coalition first filed their petitions to intervene and requests for hearing in opposition to the Holtec Central Interim Storage Facility proposal on September 14th, 2018. So that was a couple months ago. We covered that on the show. 40 technical and legal contentions of opposition, many backed up by expert witness testimony, range from environmental justice violations to lack of legal authorization for such a storage facility for this high-level radioactive waste, and a broad range of concerns regarding public health, safety, security, and the environment. So we're at another step in the legal process trying to stop this centralized interim storage facility?
Centralized or consolidated interim storage facility.
So can you tell us what's going on next week and what's important about this legal story going on?
It's a big moment. So a week from now in Albuquerque, New Mexico, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Atomic Safety and Licensing Board will be holding what are called oral argument pre-hearings. So they're going to determine if opponents to this mega dump have legal standing, if our objections, our contentions are meritorious and deserve a full-blown hearing on the merits of the issues. And so this has been in the works since Holtec International filed this license application in the spring of 2017. So it's come to this moment, and our attorneys representing a broad coalition of environmental groups. You've got a local grassroots environmental justice group in New Mexico called Alliance for Environmental Strategies. You have the biggest environmental group in the country, Sierra Club. You've got Beyond Nuclear. You've got a coalition of seven groups from coast to coast. All of our attorneys on our side will be defending our intervention petitions. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission staff will be allied with the company, Holtec International, in trying to get rid of us as much as possible. And truth be told, the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board itself, this quasi-judicial body, this administrative law panel at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, is itself captured by the industry. Just look at its record. Look at how many times it has ruled in favor of the applicants, the companies. It's most of the time, maybe all the time, truth be told. So we know we're entering into a very rigged process, rigged against us, but we're going to do our best. And a big part of it is to try to wake up the people of New Mexico, to try to wake up the state government, try to activate the congressional delegation and say, hey, look, you know, Nevada, as an example, in its fight against the Yucca Mountain dump for decades, for a generation, stood up and has defended itself. And New Mexico is going to have to do that. We are small nonprofit environmental groups taking on, truth be told, a $1 trillion industry. If you want to add it all up, this particular project may only be billions or tens of billions in size.
Budgets you would love to have.
That's what we're up against. We're up against some of the biggest pro-nuclear law firms in the country. We're up against the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the Department of Energy, which would be the sole client for this dump, which is itself a tens of billions of dollars per year agency. That's what we're up against. And it's going to take not only New Mexico, but the American people to stand up, because guess what? To move the waste out there for this centralized interim storage facility would require 10,000 shipments, mostly by rail, through places like Washington, D.C. and 44 other states to get it out there. A very high-risk proposition that they are not so slowly trying to launch at this point.
So this is high-level radioactive waste that they're proposing, as you were just saying, shipping around the country. Can you just explain for listeners? So the Yucca dump, I think, is something that is much more broadly in mainstream understanding, and listeners may have heard of the Yucca dump. Harry Reid, we know, has gone to the mat over and over to try to prevent the Yucca dump from happening. And that's been, you know, in the general zeitgeist, I think, for a couple of decades. I don't think as many people have heard of Holtec, and I know we've talked a lot about it on the show, but could you just kind of contrast the two? Are these proposals that are, you know, if Yucca got approved, would this one not happen? And is yucca also high-level radioactive waste? What are the differences in these two proposals?
And Kevin, before you answer, I just want to let our audience know what this segment is. It's called Beyond Nuclear. You can hear us every Wednesday at Loud and Clear. Beyond Nuclear, where we talk to Kevin Camps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. His website is beyondnuclear.org. Also in the studio, Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Go ahead, Kevin Camps.
Because long-serving Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid from Nevada and President Barack Obama successfully ended the Yucca Mountain Dump Project, here we are at Plan B, unfortunately, established, unfortunately, by Obama's own Blue Ribbon Commission on America's Nuclear Future. If we can't do yucca, then what are we going to do? Oh, well, maybe we'll do centralized interim storage. So here we go. We are facing that now in this pitted battle. And so yucca was limited. It's not going to happen. The fight goes on. House Republicans especially are still trying to open the yucca dump against the state's will, against the will of the Western Shoshone Indians, whose land it is at yucca. Yucca is limited to 70,000 metric tons of high-level radioactive waste. Guess what? We have a lot more than that in this country already. So by spring of 2010, yucca, which will never open, was full. And they would need a second repository in this country. We don't have the first one. Not even close. It's a half century away, essentially. Maybe, if we're lucky. So here we go with a proposal in New Mexico by this company called Holtec International, which is pretty infamous. And they want to put 173,000, two and a half times the size of yucca. That's how much waste they want to park in the semi-arid desert of southeastern New Mexico, where, truth be told, if it gets there, it's probably never going to leave. I mean, imagine what that congressional vote would look like. Should we move the waste again? One vote in favor of moving it, 434 votes against moving it. So it's going to get stuck there.
So interim is a loosely used word in this case. Interim means like for the next, say, 10 or 20,000 years.
Well, the Holtec company itself has used various figures. They've said 40 years, 100 years, 120 years, 300 years. They have literally used those figures. But the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, to show you how absurd this all is, they have said indefinite away from reactor storage is safe and sound no matter how long it goes on for. And they assume things like once every 100 years, the entire facility will be replaced from top to bottom. No funding mechanism to do that, but they assume that every 100 years, if things start to degrade and leaks start to happen, they'll simply replace everything. Well, that's science fiction fantasy.
Talk about kicking the can down the road, except this time the can is filled
high-level nuclear radioactive waste.
And large, huge quantities of it.
NRC's policy is called Nuclear Waste Confidence, but we so called them out on that. We called it the Nuke Waste Con Game, the Nuclear Waste Confidence Game, that they had to change the name. And they changed it to Continued Storage of Spent Nuclear Fuel. And unfortunately, in 2016, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission got the second highest court in the land, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, including a justice named Kavanaugh.
Heard of him?
Yeah. Brett Kavanaugh voted in favor of NRC's nuclear waste confidence policy and said, all you troublemakers out there, go away. And the troublemakers included a coalition of states, including New York and Vermont and a couple others, and a large coalition of environmental groups saying, Your Honors, this environmental impact statement is bogus. I mean, look at this science fiction fantasy. And the court, one of the aspects of the ruling that stuck in my craw the worst was the court said in its ruling explicitly, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would never let institutional control be lost on this waste. Well, the thing is, by definition, institutional control will be lost on this waste. There is no society that has lasted more than, you know, the Catholic Church, for example. How old is that? A couple thousand years old. Tibetan Buddhism, 5,000 years old. This waste will remain deadly for a million years into the future. So the court, really, that was an absurd thing to say. We have lost institutional control on high-level radioactive waste in this country in real time. They have actually lost irradiated nuclear fuel. They don't know where it went. That's happened in the past. It's been documented. And as we speak, with this partial government shutdown, the venue for our proceeding had to be changed. The licensing board had to scramble to find an alternative venue because the U.S. courthouse is closed. So in a sense, the beginnings of loss of institutional control in New Mexico have already begun.
Yeah, and that's within, you know, weeks after a government shutdown. And again, a government shutdown over a bogus issue. The issue of building the wall to stop the army of undocumented immigrants coming to the United States. Yeah, all of that can be changed. Everything can become unstable. Guess what? Everything will change and everything will become unstable because it's the nature of politics. It's the nature of everything here. Kevin, when we're talking about the resistance inside New Mexico, I want to flag that again because we talked at the beginning of this show about the resistance of people. The resistance of people in Nevada led to a change with the Yucca dump. That must not have been the majority sentiment when you started. In other words, there had to be groundwork laid, grassroots organizing, educating, mobilizing, all of that work that grassroots organizers do without success. You know, you're just kind of feeling like you're hitting your head against a brick wall over and over again, but you persevere, you keep going. Like in the same spirit that Rosa Parks and her colleagues and comrades kept doing the same thing over and over again until finally one day it set the spark and something changed. Where every time they did it before, it didn't change. The status quo, the fear, the intimidation, whatever you want to call it, the things that make change hard were dominant. And then suddenly change did happen. When you think about New Mexico and Nevada, let's just make a comparison. How did it come to be that consciousness changed in Nevada? And will the same tactics and the same process, can you anticipate that also happening in New Mexico?
Yeah, absolutely. The history in Nevada is very inspiring to me and to a lot of people. The Western Shoshone Indians, the spiritual leader Corbin Harney, who held demonstrations at the Nevada test site for decades. A part of the Nevada story is that they had suffered the consequences of the Nevada nuclear weapons test site, the fallout downwind. A lot of people died. A lot of people got sick. That extended into Utah with the Mormons in St. George, Utah, immediately downwind of the test site. So that suffering led to the pushback. And Nevada said, when the federal government came along and said, you know what, screw Nevada, we're going to dump the waste out there too. Nevada said, nope, we've taken one for the team. You're not getting away with this. And they messed with the wrong rookie senator in 1987. That was Harry Reid. He devoted his career to stopping the dump. But it was a pretty amazing coalition, like I said, of traditional Native Americans, Mormons in Utah, political ambitious types like Harry Reid, who became leader of the Democrats in the Senate. You know, the nuclear industry did not see that happening. In Nevada, that's the history. In New Mexico, there's a similar history. You know, New Mexico, because of Senator Domenici, long-serving, most pro-nuclear senator of the past generation, he wanted to turn West Texas all the way up to northwestern New Mexico into a nuclear corridor. He called it that. He came out of Albuquerque, mayor of Albuquerque, Sandia National Lab, Los Alamos National Lab nearby, and he was as pro-nuke as they come. And there have been the development of so many watchdog groups in New Mexico by necessity, watchdogging Los Alamos, watchdogging Sandia, then watchdogging the waste isolation pilot plant, the military plutonium dump in the United States that got foisted on New Mexico despite widespread resistance in the state. So here we go again, this attitude of the nuclear establishment in industry and government that there are nuclear sacrifice areas in this country, Nevada, New Mexico, and the fight is on now to stop what is, you know, 2.5 times bigger than Yucca being targeted at the surface of southeastern New Mexico.
Wow, that's a really inspiring story. I'm looking forward to seeing that unfold. It'll be great. We've got two more stories that I would love to get to. So let's just start by saying we've talked about this book on the show before, The Confessions of a Rogue Nuclear Regulator. It's Greg Jasko. He's a former NRC chairman, and he has this new book. He's going to be talking about it tonight. This is Wednesday, the 16th of January. He's going to be talking about it tonight down at the Wharf, the Politics and Prose Wharf, Wharf location at 7 p.m. Hopefully we can get to this whole wild tale about how he got ousted. But first, let's talk about the PG&E bankruptcy and what that means for Diablo Canyon shutdown agreement. We've only got 3 minutes left, Kevin. So if you can talk to us about this bankruptcy, this is the California Electricity and Utility Commission that was sued because they had some shady dealings, didn't do all the repairs that they should have been doing out in California, and then that caused 17 wildfires. They've been sued, but before they were sued and before all of this happened, they made some great deals to go ahead and shut down some nuclear reactors. So can you tell us more about, are those deals still good? What's going to happen there?
Yeah, I mean, scores of Californians died in those wildfires, and thousands of structures were destroyed. And so here's PG&E declaring bankruptcy. They're facing $30 billion in liabilities for those wildfires. And the question is, will the shutdown agreement hammered out a couple years ago on Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant hold? And hopefully, you know, in a sane world, it would require the immediate shutdown of Diablo Canyon because the company's bankrupt. How are they going to maintain safety for the next several years before shutdown as a bankrupt company? In this world, the nuclear power plant could be looked to as a financial asset. Let's keep it running. Let's get some revenue stream to help deal with this bankruptcy. So hopefully the shutdown can be preserved. And another danger is that energy efficiency, electric vehicles, renewables, that's where PG&E was going with the Diablo Canyon shutdown, was into that realm. Can we preserve those victories? Or is it all going to be wiped away and the bad ideas come to the forefront again? That's what's at stake out in California.
So we've got just 1 minute left. There's a couple of pieces that are interesting here. I mean, do you think that they're going to be able to, I mean, Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E, will keep running like it's, you know, private public, but like they are going to keep running because California doesn't have another utility to keep running. But one other thing I wanted to ask you about, in the write-up in Beyond Nuclear, it says that Diablo Canyon would be the first operating power plant to not seek a 20-year extension from the NRC.
Right. The NRC hands out these extensions like rubber stamps. And this deal was such a big deal because this company, PG&E, said, no, we're not going to seek a 20-year license extension. We're going to shut down at the 40-year termination of our license. It was a victory. We want them shut down now because anything can happen between now and 2025 when the shutdown would be consummated. So, you know, shut it down now.
Yeah. Well, next time we'll have to talk about this crazy tale about getting Greg Jasko, somebody who mostly ruled with the nuclear companies, but occasionally would succumb to pressure from the people and rule positively on important nuclear shutdown issues and nuclear waste issues.
The book is Confessions of a Rogue Nuclear Regulator. Let's talk about that next week. Right now, we are completely out of time. We're joined in studio by Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can read about his work and the work of the group at beyondnuclear.org. Be sure to get involved with them, support them. And we're also joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, communitypublicradio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.